I represent the appellant in this matter, Anthony Burries. Mr. Burries is appealing from his conviction first-degree murder and the death of Tina Holt. We have raised seven assignments of error, not inclusive of an eighth assignment of error, which alleges various matters related to the effective assistance of counsel. The first seven, I think, are most appropriate to discuss today. Primarily, the allegation here, our assignment of error, that the court, in trying Mr. Burries, allowed a large amount of prior bad acts, testimony, and evidence that we feel became the focus of this case. There was testimony, obviously, from an eyewitness, Harmony Howard, that in which she claimed that she was present at the time that Mr. Burries actually drove Mr. Burries to the scene of this crime. However, a lot of this focus, I believe, was lost in this case based on the voluminous testimony and evidence regarding both the 2012 assault. There was a certified copy of a conviction. Early during the trial, there was a lot of testimony regarding the circumstances surrounding that assault. There was a lot of testimony regarding Ms. Holt's appearance following that assault. It was graphic. It was detailed. It was redundant at times. And again, there were 404 hearings. There were hearings, John. Regarding that two-passing club incident. There were. We had an omnibus motion of this eliminate that was filed by trial counsel. I will note for the court, I was not trial counsel representing Mr. Burries now on appeal. Trial counsel filed an omnibus motion eliminate in which he sought to exclude the evidence regarding the 2012 assault as well as the details that many of the witnesses testified to regarding that assault. As well, there were additional matters. The witnesses were permitted to testify to, the analysis changes as we get closer and closer to the time to the assault's death. However, we're at least submitting the court, we'd like the court to consider along that entire spectrum. At what point did this become either more prejudicial than probative or fail to satisfy all the elements of 404-2 analysis? I did cite Sanchez, which sets forth the basic test on those types of statements. Now,
is there one item in my 404 hearing that you're focusing on that's being prejudicial?
I believe we're probably focusing most exclusively on the 2012 conviction and the testimony that sort of flushes out what allegedly happened and as we said before, Ms. Holt's appearance. I believe there was at least one witness testifying that she had black and blue eyes, and it was hard to see her eyes even because she was so beat up. And that obviously we're not here arguing that that's that was okay because that's happening as whole or anything of that nature. But what we are arguing is that the evidence, this alleged homicide, this alleged murder, occurred almost 17 months later. It occurred.
Is there something about the facts? This particular case, it seems to me that the state's position is that this was a domestic violence case that ultimately results in murder. Is there something about the facts or those kinds of cases that would argue for the admission of these other acts that were preceded by this?
And that's a good question, Your Honor. And ultimately, I think the state's going to sort of push you toward that direction. I think the state's going to argue that this type of offense, when you have a person alleged to commit the offense who's a boyfriend, for instance, and there's a history of domestic violence in that relationship, that weighs in favor of admitting evidence of that history. What we want to focus, I actually offered a parallel to a case, I believe it's Rodriguez, it's a drug case. And bear with me for a moment, I know there are different types of cases, but I believe that you can sort of take some of the reasoning from that. There was evidence, again, a spectrum of evidence. There was evidence that the guy buying the drugs smoked methamphetamine with the seller of the drugs. But then there was also evidence regarding past drug transactions that had happened months earlier. And, the court, I think, correctly surmised that, yes, this evidence that you were smoking during this drug transaction as part of the charged offense, yeah, that's absolutely admissible, but this drug transaction happened months and months and months earlier. That's not really part and parcel to the story of the crime. Now, I don't believe that any differences between that sort of prior bad act, that's what we're calling it, and the prior bad act of having a domestic violence case, if anything, to me, the nature of the crime almost makes it more prejudicial because it shows that somebody is a violent person, that this is part of their DNA, and for somebody at that point to say, well, like the state, for instance, in its closing argument, to say, well, he's a dangerous, violent person, and I'm paraphrasing. The state came out in closing argument and said, essentially, he's a quick suspect for everybody. He's a dangerous, violent person.
Counsel, was some of this evidence blended together to show a picture of the relationship between Mr. Burris and Ms. Burris?
All right, so again, that's another question as to which is it part of the story of this murder?
Such as access to the apartment and having keys in the place.
Right, that I believe could have been accomplished or was accomplished by other testimony that Mr. Burris, that she had told other people that she was scared he was in the apartment. And that was a little closer in time. I'm going to leave that to the court's discretion. I mean, we've argued against all of it.
So more of the 2014 comments, the month or so leading up to the murder, maybe aren't as relevant to your argument?
I'm not going to be conceding anything, but I will say that as you get closer to the actual event, the actual crime, it gets harder and harder to make that argument. That said, I don't want to cede anything because there are other objections that were made to some of those statements, and those are mentioned in our brief. Hearsay, excited, the trial court held excited utterance applied here in one of them, and there were a couple other things. I think present sense impression that the court listed a few in its order. And I think our big point on those is that if you use that to get around some of the problems with the foundation and some of the other issues we raised with those statements, at some point it becomes a little bit too it got muddled there. I believe the things started kind of getting bootstrapped in. It was sort of like, well, if we're going to let this in, we may as well let the rest of this in. And so when you start with that 2012 conviction, it seemed to open the door to a lot of what I believe would be other highly prejudicial, but possibly less probative than it should have been evidence.
Counsel,
yes. Limiting instructions were given on a few occasions during trial.
What's different about your client going to some issues?
Well, limiting instructions, first of all, they were given on some occasions. There were other occasions that trial counsel may not have objected.
Well, was it given? Was it part of the jury instruction?
If I recall, it was. Yes, and...
Was it handled before or during the testimony of each of the 404 witnesses?
Several of them. And, you know, I didn't make a large issue of that in my brief. I will suggest that the instructions, if the court's weighing out whether those instructions had a curative effect here, the instructions were generic. They were, you know, they didn't really get to the heart of why this evidence was being offered. And if you look at our argument, that's one of the points I tried to make, which is that the court essentially let this stuff in, the stuff that we're objecting to, let it all in based on a very generic sort of all-encompassing reading of 4042. It said this comes in to prove opportunity motive, basically quoted the statute. There's cases that say that's inappropriate. But you're not supposed to allow a bunch of 404 evidence in when it's objected to just based on a generic reading of the statute. You're supposed to, the trial court's supposed to find specifically why is this being admitted. For each piece of 404 evidence, why is it being admitted, weigh it against the probative value, the prejudicial versus the probative value, and make a determination.
Was there any comment by the trial court as to how this, these 404 pieces
You know, you have to go back. I mean, there's a lot we're talking about, so it's kind of hard to say this is an oral argument. If you go back to the order, he did make some specific findings in the order, but he didn't necessarily say, if I remember right, there was... It's a good question, Your Honor. It's definitely in the order. I can't, again, because there are so many different things that were offered, so many different types of or pieces of evidence, it's hard for me to say one or the other. But yes, it's in the order, and I'm not going to suggest that the court didn't make any findings, but usually, or toward the end, it seemed to just keep repeating the same thing. It's offered, this evidence is accepted to prove. Offer mistake or lack of mistake, motive.
Was there argument by the state as to the specific relevance given the nature of the crime and the life cycle of the crime that's produced?
Specific evidence.
The stages and the repetition of it and why that means prior events are related.
If you're talking about during the 404 hearing?
Or at any point. When the state's version,
yeah. You know, while the state's promoting this evidence to the trial court, I believe that they made comment on that. I don't recall actual evidence being offered in the form of expert testimony of that. It was primarily, there was certainly assertions made by the county attorney that this is how domestic violence, perpetrators, of course, they continue to victimize. And it's all part of the pattern of victimization. Right. Yeah, I'd already, if I recall, but I do not recall anything, especially in terms of expert testimony or anything of that nature, to suggest that this is somehow, probative in any other way other than to show that, this is, again, part of the story. That was the state's biggest argument in its favor, and still on appeal, that's the state's, I believe, state's primary argument.
Find that it was inextricably intertwined exceptions to the 404 rule. Most of this evidence was raised yesterday. It just showed the entirety of the story. Is that somewhat what the court did in considering the 404 evidence?
Yeah, that's a fair summation of how the court decided to allow it. But I think that whether there's some relation, of course there's some relation to the victims in this case, the fact that there was this assault, the fact that there was a conviction entered against Mr. Burris. But when you do the 404-2 analysis, a big part of that analysis, prejudicial effect versus probative value, and I mean that's clearly got to be considered a high prejudicial effect. When you have a conviction for assaulting the victim, I mean, if this wasn't a domestic violence case, say this was just a, two non-domestic partners, two people, one assaults the other 2 years, almost 2 years prior, and then this person ends up murdered down the road. I mean, to me, is there any probative value there? I mean, it's almost as though we're saying, well, you know, if you harm somebody at some point in your life and that person ends up murdered, just so you know, that's quite possibly coming against you at your trial for their murder.
Did Mr. Burris go to prison after the first assault in 2012?
He did. He was in jail.
And how long was
he in jail? He was in jail. It was just a year ago. Yeah.
When did he get out of
jail? I believe he got sentenced. He might have. For a good time, he might have been out prior to that. And I apologize for Mr. Fletcher.
And you didn't know when he got out
of jail? Yes. It was, I believe less than a year later. Following the conviction, but with that, I see on my yellow light. I'm going to have a seat and give a little time for public comments.
Thank you very much. Ms. Faust is going to you.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Stacey Faust, Assistant Attorney General representing the appellee of the state of Nebraska. There are essentially four issues in this case: the alleged 404 evidence for a statement to law enforcement, the DNA evidence, and Burry's letter to Herman and Howard. With regard to the alleged 404 evidence, I want to focus, as I did in my brief, on the specific evidence that the state offered, namely the evidence of Burry's prior assault of Holt, Beck's testimony, Robinson's testimony about Burry's threats to Holt, and Colburn's testimony that he checked Holt's apartment for Burry's one-night visit for death. The first evidence of the Burry's December 2012 assault at Holt and Beck's testimony were not withheld for evidence because they were intrinsic to the crimes charged and because they were part of the factual setting of the crimes and presented a coherent picture to the jury. This
was there a 404 hearing on this, and are there any instructions given by the court?
There was a 404 hearing. The district court found the evidence about the 2012 assault, as well as Jillian Stone's testimony, who was a neighbor of Tina Holt, that was in transit. The rest just died, the crimes charged. The rest of the 404 evidence, as it's been coined by the defendant, was given limiting instructions on. Basically, it was a recitation of the 404 statute. I'm not sure that complies with Sanchez, and I don't know if it fits every purpose, and that's why the state's position is that the most probative and most important pieces of this evidence were in transit to the crimes charged.
What does that mean? Does that mean to the jury's deliberation, if anything at all? Your argument is the fact that it's intrinsic to the crime itself. So the jury's given an instruction that it should only use the evidence for the evidence purpose.
Well, actually, I think it just made the state's job harder. Then it didn't consider it at all. It should have, actually. It should have been intrinsic to the crime charge. And now they're only hearing for those limited purposes. So I actually think it weighs in favor of the state. This evidence, along with Robinson and Coburn's testimony, along with all the undisputed evidence against Burry's, including Herman Howard's testimony, Melissa Elitch's testimony, and especially the text messages, they all fit together like a puzzle in this case. I think it's important to note that the 17 months is a deceiving amount of time because, remember, Burry's was in prison from January to November 2013. Holt was murdered in May 2014. And during his time in prison, he called and threatened Holt with death, including bashing her head in, which was ultimately how she was killed. Once he was released from prison, Holt became more secluded and more withdrawn. A few months before her death, she is in fear. She's wanting to stay at her friend's house. More often, she is displaying more bruising up until that time. And then we have in April 2014, just a month before her death, Terry Robinson, a friend and neighbor of the victim, answered her phone. And the phone said Tony on it. And Tony told Robinson that he did time for Holt once and he was not scared to do it again. And we can't understand this threat unless we know about his prior conviction. And finally, explained so much about the events of the week of her death. 5 days before her death, she woke up another neighbor to check her apartment because she thought he was there. This shows access to her apartment and her fear of him the week of her death, even though they're in this long, ongoing relationship. We actually now know the context of their relationship. 4 days before her death, Robinson hears the same man that he heard yelling at her in April, and Holt tells him that Tony threatened to beat her, revive her, and beat her again to death. And also the day before her death, she texts Bertie that she does not feel safe or comfortable around him, about his threats to torture her, and that she owed him a limb. It explains why law enforcement focused on him during the investigation. And it explains his own statements to Elidge and Detective Cahill about getting rid of his clothing from his prior assault of Holt. All of it fits together with the admissible evidence, the regular substantive evidence, it all fits together in the district court.
In your brief, you talk about some storage of former evidence and some things you argue really much talking about. But then at the end, you say that any remaining formal evidence that there is an error is harmless. Is there a theorem of the fact issue that you have to worry about in this case? In other words, is there a point where there's too much evidence to constitute harmless error?
No, not in this case. In that paragraph for that harmless error portion, it was very, there was like two remaining issues, I believe. Colburn's testimony about a threat that he heard in the parking lot about a month before her death, about going to find her or something if she wasn't home. And then about a neighbor hearing fighting a couple of nights that she couldn't say who she was fighting with. That's really all I was talking about in that paragraph. So with all the evidence that I argued for that time there, not to mention the near or long evidence against him and the main statement of facts. I just don't think that matters for that time. I'll move on to the second assignment error. There's no further questions on that assignment error, which is Bury's statement to law enforcement. And this court applies a totality of circumstances test to review whether a waiver is knowingly and voluntarily made. And based on the totality of the circumstances, Bury's voluntarily waived his right to counsel before he made statements to Detective Cahill for a variety of reasons. The first is that the Miranda rights were read to him by Detective Cahill, and exactly how they were read was how they were upheld in this court by this court's statement to me. Burry's responded that he understood in each and every one of those rights, ages to be considered, I think I believe he's in his 30s or 40s, his intellect is to be considered. Detective Cahill described him as pretty intelligent. He obviously has had prior contact with authorities, and once you listen to the interview, he was relatively calm throughout the interview. He agreed to speak with limitations, he told Detective Cahill, and he stated during the middle of the interview that he was not going to throw the lawyer word out there right now. But then when he's confronted with the evidence against him, namely Harmony Howard, he unequivocally invokes his right to counsel, which I think 100% evidences that he knew he had the right to counsel during that interview. The I don't know when, don't know how comments that he made of when he's going to get counsel does not show that he didn't understand his right to counsel. I think the rest of the factors absolutely show that he did. The interview itself shows he wanted to talk to Detective Cahill. I think he was trying to be smart and he was trying to talk his way out of it and he was trying to explain things. And then as soon as Detective Cahill played the card of Harmony Howard and the fact that she's an eyewitness, he Burry's knew he couldn't talk anymore. And that's when he invoked. And I think that makes his statements voluntary, and Miranda certainly was not violated in this case. The third assignment error is the DNA evidence, and Burry's defenses of ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim for eliciting testimony from the forensic analyst about inconclusive DNA test results from the blood smear that was found on Colt's arm. He claims it's inconclusive in any event. The state does not believe it is. Unlike in the court's Johnson case, which is what Burry's compares this case to, it was not the expert's opinion that the DNA sample was a mixture, even a possible mixture. Her testimony in this case was that it came from a single contributor, the victim, Tina Holt. She testified that the additional number was an artifact, and she believed it was an artifact commonly found in DNA testing because it was found in a stutter position, which is a common product of DNA testing. And they was a relief that it was not an additional allele. And unlike the Johnson case, the defendant's profile here was not compared to the sample, leaving open possibility to the jury that it could possibly come from him. In any event, Liz's testimony establishes she couldn't even compare anyone's profile to just one allele, if it were a true allele. And then the final assignment of error is his letter to Harmony Howard. The state submits this is not 404, it's actually direct evidence. He sent it to her approximately a week before her trial testimony. It was his attempt to intimidate her. She was the state's primary witness, and thus it was highly probative of his consciousness of guilt.
Should some of that letter have been redacted?
I think the parenting portions, the derogatory comments about her parenting, put into the admissible portions of the letter into context, so no. But even if trial counsel didn't request it, and this is an ineffective assistant counsel claim, but also I think almost probative and harmful, prejudicial parts to Burry's were the parts that were admissible. So I, if anything, the derogatory parts of the letter actually put Harmony into a bad light and not necessarily Burry's.
If there are no further questions, we ask you for a judgment of support.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have time for rebuttal?
He has 4 minutes, 21 seconds.
4 minutes and 21 seconds, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Unless there are any further questions on what we contend was 404 evidence, I thought I might touch on this DNA issue, if the court will allow me. It's an ineffective assistance claim, and the reason we're claiming the trial counsel provided ineffective assistance is that he actually opened the door for testimony that this artifact, as the state called it, call what you will, it wasn't Tina Holt's DNA. So what we're arguing is that by opening the door to forensic testimony, that this artifact could have come from a client, trial counsel provided the ineffective assistance.
What in the record indicates could have come from her client?
Well, she said that it was inconclusive as to the source. And then trial counsel actually elicited testimony suggesting that the blood could have come from somebody other than Holt, and that Burry's, Mr. Burry's, could not be excluded as a potential source. That's our reading of the testimony. Now, the thing is, what the state's done is it's said, well, it's done what it should do. It's gone back through the direct testimony and said, logically, this is what she said. Well, okay, but this court specifically found that DNA evidence, particularly if it's misrepresented or presented in the absence of proper, statistics so that it can be evaluated properly, is highly prejudicial. It's found that in the Johnson case, and I believe it should find that here. DNA evidence is extremely prejudicial, and if it's presented improperly without the statistics that bear it out, it can be misinterpreted. And by opening the door for that to happen, trial counsel provided effective assistance. Now, ultimately, the prejudicial effect, it's hard to say, but it's not, if there's a reasonable likelihood that it affected the outcome, then that's a fair statement. True, but
in other words, you can't say your client is the source, but you can't say anyone else.
Well, if you look at what trial counsel did, and again, the argument's not necessarily with science or with your logic, Your Honor. It's with what trial counsel did and what he suggested to the jury.
All the state offers in this letter aren't talked about.
Correct. The trial counsel got up and raised the question as to whether something in that DNA test shows that it was actually, could have been, my client.
And how did the DNA expert respond to that?
It's, well, if I remember, correctly, she had to admit, yes, I can't say for sure that this couldn't have come from somebody else. And obviously, you can go back and review the testimony, but that's my memory of what she says. So I'm afraid I don't have to read the full thing here, but I do have, you know, what we put in her brief. And that's essentially what we summarized what I was saying. As her, well, I think it opened the possibility of that Mr. Burry's contributed something to the sample that was found on Ms. Holt's arm. And that possibility, especially in the absence of statistics, is troubling. You know, and then because of the nature of the testimony. Now, here's the thing. The state didn't have to present any of that. I mean, the state made a decision to present it because it didn't want to leave that door open. It wanted to close that door. But that was the, and so I can't blame the state for presenting the evidence. But what I can do is blame trial counsel for taking that witness and putting it in a, putting her in a position where, you know, she's actually potentially exculpating her client. But anyway, I see I'm at zero time now, Your Honors. I really do appreciate the time. We're asking the court to reverse Mr. Burry's convictions. One last thing I will mention, he's asked me to mention, there was some things that we raised in the final assignment of error, particularly Detective King admitting that there was a witness that hadn't properly investigated that says that she saw the victim the day after she was with him. So, there's nothing further for the court to review that. Well, that was a cross-examination of Detective King. And there's a whole list, as you know, in Assignment of Error 8. There may be a chance that some of these issues are not addressed here at this point because of the record not being developed enough, but my client specifically asked for their attention, so I appreciate the
right. Was this all under your suggestion of ineffective counsel to be able to investigate?
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Were you appointed in this matter, Mr. Wilson?
I was not. Thank you. Thank you.
Next case of the day is Douglas County versus Archie.